Hello, and welcome to a special episode of Justice Society Presents. This is our anthology podcast feed featuring a variety of shows and hosts celebrating some of our favorite comics and characters associated with the golden age of comics, Earth 2, the JSA, and beyond. Now, today's discussion is a standalone episode all about the classic 1993 miniseries by James Robinson and Paul Smith entitled The Golden Age. I'm one of your hosts today, the irredeemable Atomic Bomb, Shag, but I brought along a collection of all-star JSA fans, including Rob Botman, Kelly.
Hello.
Chris TNT Franklin.
Boom!
And joining us is Noah Dynamite Tarnow.
I have 1,000 bright tomorrows ahead of me.
Yes, you do, young lad. Yes, you do.
If only I knew.
This is a special Patreon fueled episode. The suggestion to cover this miniseries came from one of our patrons, Mr. Noah Tarnow himself. Hey, how'd that work out? Thank you, Noah, for your support and this suggestion. So, Noah, what made you want us to cover this particular story?
Well, this is one of my favorite comic book miniseries ever. In fact, I mean, we'll get to it, but I think issue number 4, the final issue, is definitely one of my single favorite comic book issues ever. I mean, it's top 5. It's probably my favorite action climax scene in a superhero comic ever. And, you know, I read this off the stands in 1993. And by the way, I think Mike's Amazing World is wrong about this, because if memory serves, this took a long time to come out. Like, Mike's Amazing World has it, you know, every month, first issue August 93, second issue September. I think it took almost a year for this whole thing to come out. I remember buying them issue by issue at the crummy little basement comic book store in the small town where I went to college. It was my freshman year of college. Anyway, but I was waiting for each issue very eagerly. And, you know, being one of my favorites ever, and being that I love the JSA and all the Golden Age characters, and being that I love what you guys do, I'm like, it's a chocolate and peanut butter thing. It makes sense. You guys should do this at some point. So at some point I said, hey, how about doing Golden Age? And Shag said, you want to join us? And I said, that's a big 10-4. So
it didn't even take a split second for me to suggest to the guys, anyone want to cover Golden Age? I mean, everyone's tripping over each other to do this because it's such a beloved comic. And by the way, I worked at that crummy basement comic book store.
No, you did not. There was a very old and very creepy guy there, Shag. So trust me, that was not you.
Fair enough. We're in Florida. We weren't in a basement, actually. So, and it wasn't crummy. It was a great comic shop. But see, I'm going to argue with you. I don't have any recollection of this being late off the shelves. Yeah, so I think
maybe deliveries were coming into that town in Minnesota via Yak, so maybe it just doesn't matter. So,
well, maybe somebody at home can chime in and tell us their memories as well. And Rob, where are they gonna chime in?
You go to fireandwaterpodcast.com. You think I'd remember our website address at this point?
You would think so. And look for the JSA Present Show and comment on this episode. Well, no, I'm really glad you suggested this because, again, it's beloved. I mean, one of our shows on this channel or feed is, of course, the Starman Chronicles, and that wouldn't have happened without this comic. Right, Chris?
No, definitely. This begins James Robinson's connection to the JSA, and as we will discuss, the continuity from this story, despite its Elseworlds tag, definitely affects Starman. So
yeah. Now, Rob, I know you were in your "I'm all grown up and stuffy and I hate comics" phase of your life at this point. Did you read this thing after the fact, or when did you come to it?
I must have just gotten it as a trade paperback. I don't remember finding it on the stands, and I think probably, I mean, first of all, the subject matter appealed to me because it's, JSA and World War II, but then drawn by Paul Smith, who's always been one of my favorites, and we'll more on that in a minute. But, I think you can count on one hand the number of DC comics he's actually drawn. So that was just like, wow, how did I miss this when it came out? And then I got it and I absolutely loved it. And then I would dig it out every so often and reread it. Like, boy, this thing is just terrific. And then I haven't read it for a long time. And then when Noah brought it up, I thought, yeah, that'd be great because that thing's terrific.
Yeah. Now, Chris, one last question before we get into our sponsors. Were you working in a comic shop at this time? Were you reading it off the – how did you come to Golden Age?
No, actually, I wasn't working there yet. And it actually – when it came out, I was entering my freshman year of college too. And because of that, I bought issue 1 – from my old comic shop in Lexington, Kentucky, that I would go to like once a month and pick up my books. But I just picked it up off the shelf. It wasn't in my pull file. And I kept forgetting to ask to have it put in my pull file. So I didn't get issues 2 through 4. But then when I got my job at the comic shop in my college town, White Crow Comics in Moorhead, Kentucky, I actually, that was one of the first things I bought with my discount was the trade paperback.
Perfect.
So I've got issue number 1 in the trade paperback. So.
That's awesome. I was working at Cosmic Cat at the time. And so I was, you know, dying for every issue, being a JSA fan, and just fell in love with it instantly. So we'll talk more about our passion for it a little bit, I guess. But so before we do that, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Justice Society Presents is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders to $50 or more. Now, we're going to suggest a couple of titles here that sparked our interest based on what we're covering today. I picked Agents of Atlas Complete Collection Trade Paperback Volume 2. Now, I know what you're thinking. This is Marvel. What am I doing here? But this is by Jeff Parker, who is one of my absolute favorite comic book superhero writers. He's absolutely amazing. And what he did was he crafted this 1950s team out of characters that were around in the 1950s in Marvel Comics. It includes, Jimmy Woo. It includes Aphrodite and Venus. I'm sorry, I'm trying to read from the list and I didn't prepare the name of all of them. But anyway, it's got a ton of characters from the Marvel Universe that were actually being published at the time. Characters from the 1950s. He collected them as a quote-unquote team that existed back then, brings them into modern day, and it's just really great comic book storytelling. It's really fantastic. This includes a whole bunch of miniseries. It's 448 pages altogether. I cannot recommend Agents of Atlas highly enough. Again, written by Jeff Parker. Normally retails for $39.99, but you can get it for 38% off right now. So it's $24.79 and really, really worth your time. I cannot recommend it enough. And I totally blew telling you who was on the team. I'm terribly sorry. Forgive me for that. But you can just Google it real quick and you'll see who I'm talking about. So, Rob, do you have a pick? And hopefully you can describe it better than I did.
Yes. Yes, on both counts, Shag. as I just mentioned a second ago, Paul Smith was one of the main drivers of me getting this series because he's always been one of my favorites. So I went with something that he drew, namely X-Men. This is X-Men from the Ashes trade paperback and new packaging. It reprints X-Men numbers 168 through 176, all drawn by Paul Smith. Features the Morlocks, Rogue joining the X-Men, the classic Professor Xavier is a jerk, Kitty Pryde thing. just absolutely beautifully drawn by Paul Smith. I don't even know what else to say about it. I mean, it's like the X-Men has had a lot of great artists, but man, Paul Smith is up there, and these are some of his best issues. The cover is by Art Adams, which is like putting, I don't even know, it's like icing on an already delicious cake or something. It's 240 pages, normal price $29.99. In stock trades price $18.59. You save 38%. So if you've never read these classic X-Men issues, you got to pick this up. X-Men from the Ashes.
All right. And Noah, I understand you brought a pick.
Yes, I did. I actually chose a DC collection, if you can believe that. What are the odds? I picked the hardcover Super Friends Saturday Morning Comics, hardcover volume 1. I will explain why in a moment. This collects the first 26 issues of the Super Friends comic book series, which is, I believe, is the subject of some other podcast somewhere out there in the etherwebs. It was written by the late, great E. Nelson Bridwell. It was drawn, and others. It was primarily drawn by Ramona Fraiden, who I looked up is still with us, 95 years old.
Yes.
As a gorgeous cover by Alex Toth, you know, that standard sort of Super Friends pose from the beginning of the cartoon. From the Hall of Justice come these tales of the Justice League of America, inspired by their hit 1970s animated TV series. And as I said, it collects the first 26 issues, including number 12, which I have a very distinct memory of reading at my day summer camp I went to. Some kid had it, and it had these cool-looking characters I'd never seen before called TNT and Dan the Dynamite.
Nice.
I have a very early memory of, like, I don't know these guys. They're not in the Super Friends cartoon. What are they doing here? So I've always had a bit of a fondness for those characters just because of that, because they have nifty costumes. And, of course, you know, Dan the Dynamite, big character here. 160 pages, normally $69.99, in stock trades price $40.59. You save 42%, the answer of the universe and everything.
There we go. Fantastic. Great pick. And just to redeem myself, by the way, the members of Agents of Atlas are Namora, who's Namor's cousin, Venus, Marvel Boy, the Gorilla Man, M11, the human robot, and Jimmy Woo, all legitimate characters that appeared in 1940s and 1950s Marvel Comics. So it's a really nice melding with this Golden Age story. So either way, go out to InStockTrades.com for all of your comic book trade paperback needs. Now, folks, this episode is also sponsored in part with your help with your Patreon support, because running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with so many shows, you know, it really requires a lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help, and you guys stepped up to help us cover some of those expenses and to keep the network going. So if you're enjoying shows like this on the network, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. And at certain sponsorship tiers, you'll even get mentioned on your favorite Fire & Water shows, just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JSA Presents podcast. So our thanks go out to
Alex Osias, Jason Keen, Joshua Romano, Ted Kelvington, Gord Tolton,
Keechee Baker, Joe Tonello, David A. Gutierrez, and again, a very special thanks to some stranger I've never heard of named Noah Tarnow. Now, again, just visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Now, remember, folks, as we always say, we want you to be part of the conversation, because this thing's not just beloved by us four people. I mean, everyone out there, especially if you're listening, I'm sure you're already a fan. So go out to our website again, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JSA presents. Leave your comments there. That's where most of the action's going on, where most of the conversation is. You can find us on Facebook as the Fire & Water Podcast Network. You can find us on Twitter as FW Podcast, or we have a specific Twitter for this show, which is JSA Presents. And, of course, you can email us at justicesocietypresents@gmail.com. Woof. All right. So you guys ready to do this?
Yes.
Do it.
You got your cosmic rod ready, Chris?
I don't discuss that in mixed company.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Cindy's not here, so that's fine.
at my age, it's only a gravity rod.
Oh my gosh. All right. So this is The Golden Age, issues 1-4, written by James Robinson, art by Paul Smith. So that's pencils and inks, folks. A letter is John Costanza, and colorist is Richard Ori. Now, according to Mike's Amazing World, not Noah Tarnow, but according to Mike's Amazing World, it was on the shelves from August 1993 through November 1993. Each issue was 48 pages each. Now, we're going to do a relatively brief recap of the whole story here. It is heavily borrowed from the DC Fandom Wiki, so thank you for that, and we edited it down. However, there are significant spoilers ahead, folks. Yeah. If you have not read The Golden Age, I implore you, please stop the podcast now. Yeah. Because there is some really cool, well, I don't know if cool is the right word, but some shocking moments in this series that are really worthwhile. You should experience reading rather than hearing four really old guys with gravity rods talk about. So if you haven't read it, take a pause, go do that, come back. We'll still be here waiting for you. Well, thanks for coming back. All right. So I'm going to start us off, and then each one of us will take a little bit of the recap. So as the story begins, it is the end of World War II and the beginning of the end of the glory days for both the Justice Society and the All-Star Squadron, as the teams break up and the various members face their own personal crises in the aftermath. Some examples include Johnny Chambers, of course, Johnny Quick, is now divorced from his wife, Libby Lawrence, who was Liberty Bell, and he's now putting together documentaries based on the Mystery Men. We check in with Libby herself, Liberty Bell. She is currently residing with Jonathan Law, who used to be the Tarantula. And he is struggling with both alcoholism and writer's block. Then we check in with Alan Scott, formerly Green Lantern. He's choose to retire from his duties as a superhero and instead focusing on his energies and attention on his radio network amid the growing accusations of his workers being card-carrying communists. Then Rex Tyler, who you know was formerly the Hourman, is finding out that Miraclo pills are no longer working on him anymore. Ted Knight, formerly Starman, is holed up in a sanitarium following a mental breakdown. Then we check in with Paul Crane, who is Robot Man, who is sadly losing his humanity. And then Daniel Dunbar, who is the Dynamite. He's a young guy. He's unable to stay in college, and he finds himself lost without his deceased partner, the crime-fighting TNT. And Paul Kirk, who was the Manhunter, finds himself pursued by gunmen and haunted by nightmares.
Meanwhile, America is honoring its hero, Tex Thompson, Mr. America and the America Mando, and also the most indecisive superhero of the 1940s. As he the states in triumph for apparently defeating Adolf Hitler. Tex then begins his campaign for creating a better America. To that end, Tex recruits Daniel Dunbar, Dynamite, for his purposes, as well as Robot Man and Al Pratt, the original Adam. As Tex Thompson, American Mando, forges ahead with his political campaign, he subjects Daniel Dunbar to experiments transforming his body and renaming him Dynaman, along with the promise that he's a hero the American public can trust as opposed to the mystery men of the 1940s. However, behind the scenes, Dynaman is found snorting cocaine and telling Tex Thompson that once Tex is elected as president of the United States, they will both rule the world. In addition to our JSA and All-Star Squadron heroes, our story also follows the unlikely heroes of Lance Gallant, Captain Triumph, Paula Brooks, the reformed criminal Tigress, Paul Kirk, Manhunter, and Bob Daly, the Fat Man.
Then we jump forward to 1949 and see Tex Thompson, now a senator, who is clearly aiming to run for president. His fiancée, Joan Dale, a.k.a. Miss America, a.k.a. the original post-crisis Golden Age Wonder Woman, until DC figured out they could just make Hippolyta the Golden Age Wonder Woman, shares with our heroes a secret diary revealing that Tex is actually the Ultra-Humanites, whose brain has been transplanted into Tex Thompson's body. The diary also includes an even more terrifying secret about Dynamite, which we will find out presently. In Washington, D.C., a loyalty rally is being held by the decree of President Truman. Joan Dale, Miss America, bravely goes public with the revelations about Tex being the Ultra-Humanite, but she is killed for her actions by Robot Man. Rex Tyler, our man, then exposes Tex Thompson as being the Humanite, and wait for it, reveals that Dynaman is actually Adolf Hitler. Yes, folks, they saved Hitler's brain and transplanted it into Daniel Dunbar's super-powered body.
The truth revealed, Dynaman brazenly storms out, ready to take over the world by force. Many superheroes attack Dynaman to stop him, only to either be seriously injured or killed. Paul Kirk, as Manhunter, deals with the Ultra-Humanite, while Bob Daly, a.k.a. Fat Man, bravely sacrifices himself to help Manhunter. Lance Gallant electrocutes himself in stopping Robot Man. Alan Scott returns to duty as Green Lantern, and Ted Knight comes as Starman to test out the power of his new cosmic rod on a now weakened Dynaman. Though the rod is snapped in two, Libby Lawrence uses part of it to deliver the final blow on the villain. At the end of the story, as Johnny Chambers and Libby Lawrence remarry, the Justice Society retires from active duty as a superhero group, and its various heroes go on with their lives. Johnny Chambers notices that one of the heroes who showed up to deal with Dynaman would take on the name Captain Comet and would become part of a generation of new heroes that would herald in the Silver Age.
Oof, man, that is some heavy stuff in this story. I mean, it really, really, I don't know about you guys, but it rattled me when I read it. It was just very powerful. It resonated with me. Here we are. Oh my God, we're 30 years later, aren't we? Holy crap, yeah. This thing's 30 years old. It doesn't feel, maybe because it's such a period piece, it doesn't feel like it. Wow. Well, who wants to start? I mean, I tell you what, Noah, you brought us down the path. Why don't you start by just giving us some initial impressions, things that wowed you?
Yeah, so I was completely unfamiliar with James Robinson or Paul Smith, for that matter, when I saw this, but I jumped at it because I was really, really into, you know, the DC Golden Age characters. And by the way, it's kind of interesting. You buy it as a trade paperback now, and it's called JSA The Golden Age. But originally, yeah, it was just The Golden Age. Mm-hmm. And they tacked on that JSA logo, I guess, because the JSA series at the time, the one that Robinson started, was popular. But this is really more about the non-JSA Golden Age characters. I mean, this owes a lot to Roy Thomas and all the work he did with All-Star Squadron. Which I loved growing up. That was probably second to Justice League, like on my must buy list. So I've always had a love for those characters, and seeing those characters in a story like this, it got my attention. And I've always particularly been fascinated by the concept of, you know, what if superheroes were real people? You know, what would they be like? What would their lives be like? What would the world be like? What would the country be like? You know, that explains why I love Watchmen as much as anyone, because I feel like that was the main question of Watchmen. And I read this first issue and, you know, it hit that sweet spot for me. It seemed to be a very thoughtful and creative way of exploring those ideas, with the bonus of it centering on characters I really liked. By the way, I've always thought it's ironic that I'm into superheroes having real problems, because I've always been way more a DC guy than a Marvel guy. I guess you can blame that on watching the Super Friends from when I was in the embryonic stage.
Oh.
Yeah, well, you know, that explains it. So this story really satisfied me in that regard. And of course, you got to love the art, but we'll get to the art in a minute. And I mentioned before that the final issue is one of my favorite single issues ever. I think the climax of the story is absolutely thrilling. And I remember reading it at the time. The twists completely took me by surprise. Absolutely took me by surprise. I never see things coming. Okay. I didn't guess that Marion Cotillard was Talia in The Dark Knight Rises till it happened on screen. I'm terrible at this. I remember reading this issue and literally issue 4 and literally being on the edge of my seat. Mm-hmm. I was convinced panel by panel. Oh, Hawkman's going to take him down. Nope. Oh, Johnny Quick's going to take him down. Nope. Panel by panel by panel, literally thinking it was about to end. And of course, the end being completely satisfying. And rereading it recently, even though I, you know, knew how things turn out, it really felt almost as thrilling. And this is what I think is the essence of great writing, especially since that twist that we'll get to, well, we already did it, about Hitler and Dynaman. It's so hokey on paper, but somehow it works. Somehow Robinson and Smith make it work so brilliantly. I just thought this was a great story. I'm shocked you guys haven't covered this before, because I look at this as like the best story DC ever did with those Golden Age characters.
I don't think there's any doubt we would have got to it. I think there was a little bit of apprehension, like, you know, how do we do it justice? How do we do it right?
Well, you get me. That's how you do anything justice.
Right? I was going to say, I don't know that we're doing it right today, but by golly, we're going to do it. I'll go next real quick. Like, I want to say the comparison to Watchmen is extremely apt. I mean, it really is. That, to me, at the time, I felt like this was, you know, the Watchmen for me. Because as much as I like Watchmen, I have some issues with it. This one, though, hit every sweet spot for me. It's about the JSA, my beloved JSA. I mean, I was so deep invested in them at this point in 1983 anyway. So it just really resonated with me there. Dan the Dynamite being in it, you know, from Young All-Stars. I thought I was the only one who remembered that comic. So I was so excited to see him in there. This felt like it was intelligently written compared to the rest of the comics that were on the stands. I felt like it had something to say about heroes in society. And so it just really resonated. And I tried to push it into everybody's hands that I could, that would come in the store, because I was working in the store. The problem is we never ordered a lot of copies because it was so expensive, you know, compared to other comics on the shelf. So it wasn't something we had a giant stack of. Now, I do, since you brought up the shocker ending, the reveal, I thought that was brilliant. How in issue 3, you get the reveal of the Ultra Humanite. So you think you're there. You think you've got it. You don't even know there's another reveal coming necessarily. And so when you get the big reveal of Hitler, I mean, it is so shocking. It is so well-paced. And you're right. On paper, it is hokey. They saved Hitler's brain. But damn, it works in this story. And maybe it's the Paul Smith art. I don't know. But it was really extremely well done. And the fact that when the Ultra Humanite reveal was, it's a dual reveal. It's, you know, them reading the diary and reading Tex Thompson's version of the story at the same time Manhunter is remembering. So it's all expertly done. All right, so before I keep rambling, so let's go on. So, Chris, why don't you tell us, you know, first thoughts, impressions, whatever you want to share.
Well, I will say that luckily this was not spoiled for me, even though it took me several years to read it. I don't know how, but it was not spoiled for me, the reveal about Ultra Humanite 1 and then especially Dynaman, because I remember literally going, holy shit, when I read Iron Man said Adolf Hitler, you know, and then the next, and you're right, Shag, it's that twisted, monstrous, evil face that Dynaman has with that bottom lip sucked in that sells the whole thing. I mean, he is hatred personified, and it sells it, and you're like, oh my God, it's Hitler with, it's Hitler in Superman's body, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, Dynaman is clearly, you know, a Superman analog once they've, you know, powered him up and everything. Although he looks like he's wearing an Edsel. But
that's in my notes, too.
that helmet has always struck me as weird. I always wonder what was up with that helmet. But
in the chest piece looks like the front of a, you know, a car from that era. But you know, this, it really... You know, nowadays, I really kind of bemoan the deconstructionist era of comics, because I think it did more damage than good in a lot of ways to our characters. And you know, God, that poor Batman. I mean, geez, You know, but with the Golden Age, though, I should feel that way about it too, but I can't, because it's just, it's so well done. It's so well written, even though the characters are taken in directions that some of them that I'm sure the creators probably would scoff at, and like, especially Robot Man, for instance, because he didn't have the excuse of having a villain's brain, you know, in his body. That's just him. But don't ever transplant your brain, people. That's the story. That's the crux of this story.
There's your medical advice. Okay.
Right there. Dr. Ange will tell you, don't have your brain transplant. But I still love it. I mean, it's just, I think it's, it captures that era just perfectly. The art is the writing, of course, does, but the art is just so, it evokes that beautiful Alex Raymond type Flash Gordon kind of look. I mean, everybody kind of looks like, a lot of the men look like they started, they're the sons of Buster Crabbe or something, you know?
Yes, that, yeah.
They've got that look about them. It's not simplistic like the Golden Age. It's just perfect. It's very fresh and very modern, but very classic. And that's so hard to do from an artistic level, you know, and it's just so well done. You just can't help but love it. And it's worth, despite knowing the twist, it's like watching The Sixth Sense again. You're like, okay, this all makes sense now. Mm-hmm, you know, it's like, mm-hmm. Watch it and get excited about it. Remember where you were when you figured out, oh, that's the twist, and you can love it all over again.
Yeah, that's a really good description and thought, because I felt the same way reading it, Chris. It was, even though I knew exactly where it was going, I was so involved this time. Rob, what about you, buddy?
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to what Chris just said about the Paul Smith art is really a nice. I wonder how he got involved in this, because as I said, he didn't do a lot of DC work, so. It's interesting how he got roped into this or however it happened, but there's something so perfect about his simplistic style. Is a wonderful kind of metaphor, because you've got all these kind of gleaming, beautiful surfaces, which is, and yet below all these perfect images is rot, you know, is this horrible moral rot that's happening. And I think that's, again, it's a perfect sort of, underlying theme of the story, of that everything looks great. We're post World War II America. Everything's gorgeous and everybody's lives are great. And yet there's this horrible, horrible stuff happening kind of under the ground and in the background. It features, rereading this, I had forgotten that it features one of the great gag / horrifying panels of all time, which is the, I've been sleeping with the ultra humanoid. it makes you laugh and also go, oh, yeah. Jesus. And regarding, you know, Hitler's brain, I mean, first of all, it's one of the great tropes of like 1950s paranoid cinema, which is, you know, Hitler wasn't really dead. They saved his brain. But I got to wonder, James Robinson, when he was writing this, you know, he gets the ultra humanite. Well, what's ultra humanite's shtick? Well, he transplants his brain. Mm-hmm. Well, once you're there, it's like Chekhov's ultra humanite's brain. What you've got first act, you got to transfer somebody's brain in the third act. So it's like, you know, if you're going to accept that a giant gorilla is going to running around transplant his brain, why not Hitler? I mean, there's nothing, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, on paper, if I read the pitch of this, if I had read the pitch of it before I ever read the comic, which was, you know, grim and gritty JSA, I'm like, I don't want to read that. I don't, I love those characters. But this really fits in perfectly. And also one other thing about James Robinson, he takes some liberties. Obviously this is an Elseworlds story. He's not bound by any sort of continuity, but I like that he plays with the toys that were in the toy box, as opposed to creating a new character that, you know, was never part of the DCU before to get something in the plot going. He uses the characters that we all know. I mean, yes, some of like TNT and Dana Dynamite are pretty obscure, but we knew they existed thanks to Who's Who. They're quote unquote real characters. And I like that too. To me, it gives it a little more, there's that, you know, that word is coming, Chris, verisimilitude, where it feels like, okay, these are characters that we all knew about, being moved around in different ways. But I just appreciated that, because I always felt maybe a little, it's like a crutch to say, oh, here was this other hero you never heard about. No, these are Robot Man and Green Lantern and Hawkman. And by the way, Robot Man completely terrifying in this story.
Yes.
And Robo-Man is one of the goofiest characters, and yet he is really scary in this story.
You said one of the scariest, funniest panels. The thing that came to mind is Smith has this great technique where he does these panels that are all in, it's like just the silhouette over a monochromatic background. Mm-hmm. He does it a bunch of times every issue. And one, the first scene where you see Robot Man, he basically mutilates a bunch of jewel thieves.
Yep.
And there's this silhouetted shot where he rips a guy's, is it arm? I think an arm.
I think an arm. Yeah,
and you see it. I mean, if you saw it in color, it kind of wouldn't be as haunting. But it's almost laugh out loud how explicit it is. Like, it's like a trauma film or something. Anyway, that's what I thought you were going to say. But yeah, Robot Man is pretty scary. And I like how he isn't redeemed at the end. How he doesn't have like a last minute face turn or something like the Atom does. I like how he stays horrible until the very end. He knows that Dynaman is Hitler. He doesn't care. And you know, he goes down, mm-hmm. he dies. He must be killed because he's an unstoppable monster.
So let's, you brought up an interesting point, Rob, talking about the story and James Robinson's style and technique and everything. And one of the interesting things about this is, you know, this was a $4.95 per issue thing, right? And James Robinson is pretty much an unknown at this point. So to put this unknown writer on a book for such an expensive, like $4.95, I mean, nowadays in 2022 dollars, I mean, you could buy a small house for that in the same amount of money. But it's just shocking that all James Robinson had really done at this point that he was known for was a Terminator, some Terminator stories for Dark Horse. He did a Legends of the Dark Knight story. And that's about it. So to go to Archie Goodwin and to get greenlit for this massive story, it blows my mind. I mean, what was the pitch? What did he say? What did he do that convinced them that he could pull this off? I mean, he did. But what did he do? I have no idea. Because it's, you know, it's after this that he explodes over in the Ultraverse on Firearm and then with DC Starman. So I can't possibly imagine. So let's talk about Robinson's writing. What do you guys think about it? So we'll start back with you, Noah. We'll keep following the sequel. So tell me about what you think about Robinson's writing in this thing.
Well, I said how, you know, he touched, and he certainly did this with Starman, which I adored. He touched that nerve of what the effect of being a superhero would be like on the people who are in that world. The people who are superheroes and their friends and their relatives and the supervillains as well. I mean, that was not neglected at all at Starman. So I love that stuff. If I'm going to be critical though, at the time, and I felt similarly about Starman, I really found his dialogue to be very impressive, to be very cool. And I liked how it was, it struck me as kind of, I don't know, interesting in a kind of artistic and hipster kind of way. And now, with several decades of wisdom beyond that, I do find it a little arch at times. I mean, I got to be honest, it's worse in Starman than it is here. So I'm not as – and then, of course, I'm colored by my opinions of reading things like Justice League Cry for Justice and stuff. So I'm not as – yeah, exactly.
You can't talk about those later years. He got replaced.
I know.
Someone switched his brain with somebody else.
I know. So. Someone did. Hey, I'm the one person – I'm the one person who liked the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie that he wrote. So, you know, I give him more slack than some people. But here there's very little to argue with. You know, Shag, in our notes, you talked about what we think of the characters. And it really forced me to kind of look at them, you know, each of their character arcs and look at them character by character and really see how there are so many characters here. But each one of them really has some level of depth to him. And in just four issues with this insane, incredible plot and, you know, politics, somehow all these people still have this depth and still have this story. And when many of them die, it still becomes poignant. When you see Where Are They Now segment at the very end, it really has some heft to it. And then for the geeks like us, like you said, Rob, he plays with the toys in the toy box. He does one incredibly geeky fan service thing at the end, which is, we didn't say in the recap, one of the heroes who helps take him down is this young kid who's like, I have superpowers, and they leave him out. But towards the end, he's one of the final guys to attack Dynaman, and that is revealed to be Captain Comet. After Dynaman is dead, they reveal him to be Captain Comet. And that is significant because if you're a DC nerd like me, you know that somewhere along the line, it was said or semi-established that Captain Comet was the first Silver Age DC hero.
Right, right.
Even though he's never been that big a character, and he debuted like 5 years before the Barry Allen Flash, But for some reason, it was DC lore all through the 80s. Somehow I knew this as a kid.
Yeah.
Like Captain Comet was... So to make him the avatar of the Silver Age in this world really felt like some fan service that I ate up with a spoon. So, you know, he was doing it all here, at least as far as I was concerned.
So I think we'll break down character by character in just a second. I'll just say a quick thing that I love about Robinson here is that he's telling a period piece, but it doesn't feel dated. It doesn't feel silly. It doesn't feel like a sitcom. I mean, you feel like you're legitimately living in those times and you just accept it. You don't feel like it's out of place. You don't feel like, hey, here's a fan service. Here's the way phones used to work. Ha ha ha. No, it's, you feel like you're living in those times and it feels modern, even though it's the 1940s and 50s. So I applaud him for his ability to thrust you into an era, a bygone era, without having to hang a lantern on every weird, quirky thing that's different between now and then. I think then we go to Chris. Is that right, Chris? Anything on, any thoughts on Robinson's writing before we talk about the characters?
Yeah, I think it. This story is just extremely well crafted. I mean, everything that's set up pays off. I mean, that in itself, I mean, you take that, yes, that's just good writing, but you know, sometimes that doesn't happen. You know, I mean, it really doesn't. I mean, you know, the start the story the way he does with, you know, kind of framing it with Johnny Quick and Johnny Chambers and have him making the film. And then you're, you know, what's going on with Manhunter? Why is he trying? What's he trying to remember? Why is he being chased? And you know what's and it's interesting that, you know, he already pulls in the way he uses Alan Scott to examine the you know the growing Red Scare hysteria. It's just really well developed in that first issue, but then every issue pays off a little bit more, even though he keeps introducing new characters through the series, you know, which is interesting. You know, a lot of times it would almost seem like, okay, you're adding too many spices to the mix here, but he makes it all work in the end, in that finale, which honestly, now that I've seen something similar, it feels like this is the comic equivalent of Endgame. I mean, because in some way, because everybody just keeps throwing themselves at Dynaman like they did Thanos, but who's going to take him out? Is it, you know, it's like, is it going to be, oh, is Captain Marvel come back now? She's going to take him out? No. You know, did Captain America almost take him out? No, he almost did, but yeah. You know, so it's just, you know, and that is one thing. I mean, in other stories, I would be disappointed that after all the buildup, that Alan Scott doesn't come and kick his ass, you know, because, I mean, that's the way it looks like it's going. Okay, Alan Scott's going to come in, and he's going to be, yeah, you know, Green Lantern's going to, he's the big guys here, even Johnny says, you know, and it's not. And I mean, I think that's a bold move, and it's really clever. And the fact that, you know, I love, as much as I love Starman, I love the fact that, you know, Ted Knight's too busy, you know, monologuing and gets hit with a tire, you know, because, you know, he's like, your fiend, your evil ways are finished now, you know, and he gets knocked out and then it takes Libby to, you know, grab the rod and, you know, shove it through. And I mean, that's a perfect way to end it, but who would have thought that would have worked, you know? And so it's, you know, I love Starman, and I will agree with you, Noah, that sometimes the dialogue in Starman, as much as I love it, is a little, it's a little purple, you know, it's a little, you know, sometimes characters will just say things like, well, even in this one, it's a little bit like, you know, when Iron Man throws Adam at him, he just goes, pay, you know, it's like, would he really say that in that moment? You know, I mean, it kind of works in the moment, but you know, that might be a minor criticism, but yeah, it's that's what impresses me more than anything about this, is just how well he set everything up and how he paid every single thing off.
Absolutely. So, Rob, what about you, buddy? Thoughts on Robinson's writing, and then we'll dive into character stuff.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm, you know, despite being very old, I did not live through the 40s and 50s, so I can't say that this is genuinely, you know, representative of that time, but it feels right. You know, it feels like it is. I like the way that he weaves real life political figures into the story in and out, which I think is a nice way, very effortless kind of way. The characters, it's interesting the characters he chooses to leave in and leave out. I mean, obviously he leaves out some of the real heavy hitters because it just would mess up your, like the Spectre coming in would mess up your story or whatever.
Right.
Dr. Fate or whatever. But you know, I mean, even though this is an Elseworlds story, the characters should feel somewhat recognizable to what we know. They shouldn't be too different. And they all feel kind of like the characters we know, you know, like Hawkman is this guy and Al Pratt is, you know, a little more of a kind of a simplistic guy, maybe a little easily fooled kind of thing. I you know, just the basic settings of some scene, like the toggling back and forth between day and night, it to me is very effective because you get the sense that there's like all this sort of, you know, brightly colored stuff going on in the day. And then when night falls, all of a sudden the sort of people lurk out from under their rocks and all this mysterious stuff comes out and there's all these wonderful flashbacks. The ending is particularly great. A lot of these big time stories don't have always the most satisfying endings, but I think he really finds a way to, it ends with a big fight as superhero comics are always going to, but it feels very satisfying, especially, and we'll maybe talk about it a little later, the epilogue kind of where we see what happens to all the characters I found to be particularly compelling because not everybody kind of comes out of this smelling like roses. And most importantly, he never forgets, James Robinson never forgets that even in an Elseworlds universe, Johnny Thunder is a completely worthless douchebag.
Man, you must have wrote that the day we just decided we were going to do Golden Age, and it was all leading to that moment, wasn't it, Rob?
Actually, I just thought of it in this moment, but it when I look at that panel again and him just grabbing that woman by the head, I'm like, yeah, he's just a dick. He's just
Wow. All right, so we're going to talk about the characters, but this could go a lot of different ways. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to rattle off the characters first. Then we can comment on the ones you want to. Because like I don't want everyone on the here to feel pressured. They got to say something about every character because that's not really the case. So I'm going to rattle off the characters. We've all got the list in front of us so we can cherry pick what we want to say. And then I'll go first because we'll change up the order this time. So here's all the characters that went through like their personal crises, the main focus of the story. So of course, Johnny Chambers, who's Johnny Quick. And this is worth saying, by the way, throughout most of the story, until the very end, most people aren't in costumes. Most people are just their regular suit and tie, dress, you know, whatever kind of sells. So Johnny Chambers is Johnny Quick. So in the story, he's divorced and very jaded. We've got Libby Lawrence, who is Liberty Bell. She's now in this loveless relationship with Tarantula. We've got Jonathan Law, who was Tarantula. He's battling alcoholism and writer's block. We've got Alan Scott, who was Green Lantern. You know, he's dealing with these accusations of communism that are directed at his employees and therefore creating headaches for him. We've got Rex Tyler, who's Hourman, who we find out is addicted to being a superhero. Not Miraculo, but to being a superhero. Then we've got Ted Knight, who's Starman. He's had a mental breakdown. He's been in an asylum. You've got Carter Hall, who's Hawkman. He's gone full Egyptian, man. We're talking walk like an Egyptian all the time. You've got Al Pratt, who's the Atom. He's completely insecure about being considered a hero, being a real hero, to the point where he's willing to blindly follow someone. You guys, we've talked about Paul Crane, Robot Man, who I don't know that even gets called Paul once in the story. I think he's just called Robot Man, which is effective because he's completely lost his humanity. And then we've got Paul Kirk, Manhunter, who's got amnesia and is paranoid. So I'll start off this time with just some thoughts on the characters here. So, for me, I felt like my favorite journeys in the story, and there are some characters I didn't even mention, actually, are my favorite journeys. So I think Hourman, I love his journey of going from trying to solve the Miraculo problem to thinking he's a drug addict, to realizing he's an addict, to being a hero, but yet still doing the right thing. I mean, he's the one who stands up at the end and yells that it's Hitler. You know, he's the one who stands up to do the right thing. I love that. I love his journey. I like Captain Triumph's journey. I didn't even mention him in the list, but you know, where he's battling with his ghost of his brother who keeps demanding to take control of the body. And in the end, he won't let him. In the end, he wants to be a hero himself and it costs him his life. I love Starman's journey. Just, and I don't know that he didn't have a necessarily heroic journey, but just his, from the brink of insanity, bringing himself back to trying to help and do the right thing. And then finally, Miss America. She didn't get mentioned here either, but she's Rex, Tex's fiance. Her journey was so powerful to stand up and reveal to everyone, knowing full well that it's could cost her life. Again, she goes against the plan to reveal that he's, you know, actually the ultra humanite, and it cost her life. I thought that, I mean, I don't feel like it was a fridging. I feel like it was a powerful moment for her, and I really, really thought that was great. Not great that she died, but I thought it was great that they gave her that character moment. And then I will say about Paul Kirk, about the Manhunter, his journey. The first time, I remember this, reading it the first time, his journey was irritating as hell. Like, I hated the Paul Kirk scenes in this comic the first time I read it through, because he's crazy. His memory's gone. He's having crazy dreams about eagles being operated on. He doesn't know what's going on, right? So the first time I read this through, Paul Kirk's journey irritated the hell out of me. But once you've read it through and it makes more sense, then I was like, oh, I get it now. So for me, Paul Kirk's journey eventually makes sense, but wasn't my favorite at first. All right, so we're going to switch up the order. So I went first this time, so I guess we'll go back. We'll go Rob. What about you? Any particular characters that you wanted to talk about who meant something to you?
Well, I already mentioned Robot Man. I always find it interesting when a writer can take a character that is generally regarded as maybe a little silly and can kind of just turn the knob on him a little bit, to no pun intended, to kind of make him different. You see the character in a way that nobody ever saw him before. And Robot Man was always, again, a little silly, but by really stripping away any of his humanity and the way Paul Smith draws him, he really does draw him like a robot. It is, you know, he does become kind of terrifying, which is really kind of cool. You know, I mean, again, not that I want to see, I kind of like Robot Man, but not, you know, I don't want to see him kind of dragged through the mud like this, but this is an Elseworlds story, so it's fine. But him being put through those paces, I thought was really interesting. It's really funny to me that how much of this, we mentioned Roy Thomas. I mean, obviously a lot of this bars from Roy Thomas, simply that Roy Thomas chose to tell so much of his story, or the All-Star Squadron book, through Johnny Quick, through Liberty Bell, through the kind of, I would say, not even B characters, sort of C characters, and make them take the lead. And so he bars that here, which I thought was really interesting. Captain Triumph, I thought was a really cool use of that character. And I don't think I've ever read a single Captain Triumph comic. I only know him probably from whatever appearances he had in All-Star Squadron and his Who's Who page again. But I really like that whole, I love the idea of like having this ghost that you can't get rid of. Like, mm-hmm. like that's a really fun, like, leave me the hell alone, you know? That kind of really cool. So, yeah, I mean, Paul Kirk Manhunter is really cool. Like I said earlier, these all feel like the characters that I knew from reading thousands of JSA comics, but yet it's turned a little because we're in this Elseworlds world. Those are really the ones that I came away with. So I really like what Robinson did with these guys.
Just to kind of bring your spot to a close, could you say Robot Man one more time, please?
Robot Man.
That is not how you say it. All right.
I know.
All right,
Chris. I just can't say Robot Man. It's a habit. I don't know.
Chris, could you tell us about Robot Man, please, and any other thoughts you might have?
I was always – I never knew Johnny Quick before I bought All-Star Squadron number one, but I've always liked Johnny ever since then. I just love his costume. I love the fact that Paul Smith draws him like Mort Meskin and the Golden Age artists did, in that when he's in super speed, it's just – there's not any speed lines or anything. There's just all these images of him, you know. I love his Dairy Queen swirly hair, you know, behind him. I love that when he first turns into Johnny, he's got this Johnny Quick, he puts the costume on finally, he's got this shit-eating grin on his face. You know, I just think it's funny. Yeah, you know, it captures that character. I don't know why, we've talked about this on the network before. I don't know why I love Hourman as much as I do, but God, I love Hourman. I love that costume. I just think he looks boss as hell, and Paul Smith draws the hell out of him, and this fulfilled the potential that I saw in Hourman in that JLA JSA crossover with the Secret Society of Supervillains that George Perez drew that we've all gushed about, you know.
Yep.
So it was great to, you know, and of course Hourman he appeared in James Robinson Starman, and I know it's not Rex, it's his son, but when he's on Stargirl and he shows up in that costume, I'm like, yeah, Hourman, you know. I don't know, it's just there's just something about Hourman, I just think he's cool. So I really liked what they did with him here, and I like the little twist that he's not addicted to the pills now. He's addicted to he's a action junkie. He's a superhero junkie, you know, basically. With Alan Scott, who is one of my favorite. Him and John Stewart fight over who's my favorite Green Lantern. I was a little hesitant to the New 52 revelation that Alan Scott was gay, just because he wasn't established as gay previously. But if you want to, you could read, if this Alan Scott in this story is gay, you could kind of understand what he's even more about protecting his employees, protecting their rights, protecting their their privacy, you know. So that it would, it actually would make sense. So I kind of like that aspect, and I really loved it when he had that battle with the Sportsmaster, and he just showed up and put his fist out like he's got the ring, even though he doesn't. He's like, missing something. He's like, no, not really, you know. He beat the hell out of him. I will say one thing though: Paul Smith screws up and draws the ring on the wrong hand. Alan wears his ring on the left hand usually, but. But we'll let it go. We'll let it go there. Of course, Ted Knight, I got to talk about Ted because, this is a character that James Robinson will, of course, use in Starman. I don't know if we want to go ahead and talk about it now, but we might as well. This isn't Elseworlds, but in Starman, it's kind of not. other comics is kind of not, but it really isn't in Starman because these events are obliquely referenced, and then Ted's nervous breakdown from helping develop the atomic bomb are definitely part of his character arc in Starman, and we even see him in the past right after the events probably of this. It's in 1951, so it's right around this time. So, this is Robinson laying the groundwork. I don't know if he knew he was going to do something with Starman at the time. I don't think so, actually. That's something we should mention too, that the Justice Society of America series by Len Strazewski and Mike Perlbeck had just been canceled in May of 1992. So that might be another reason why this wasn't originally branded, as Noah pointed out, it is now, as Justice Society or JSA, the Golden Age, because that title had been canceled. So unfortunately, because it was a great comic, but I like the things like, Carter Hall going all Egyptian, although I don't understand why Johnny considers, I just think he's mad because he's, gone native. But because Johnny, you say a mathematical formula out loud. What more math than that,
Yeah.
But okay. yeah,
that's what gets you going, Chris. I don't know if you saw my thing in the notes. I'm hung up on how did Hitler learn English and get rid of his German accent so quick. I'm hung up on that.
So of course, my response to all that is, guys, these people shoot lasers out of their eyes. They fly. They transplant brains, and those are the logistics that you guys are going to get hung up on.
Yeah, okay, exactly.
Sure.
Exactly.
Okay.
I've got a couple more thoughts, real quick. Manhunter. I kind of wonder. Archie Goodwin's the editor of this, of this comic. So, Robinson's like, hey, look what I did with Manhunter. And Archie Goodwin's like, hey, I like that guy. Seems like I've heard of that character before. And Captain Triumph, man, it never struck me before, but rereading this time, when he goes in knowing that he's probably going to die fighting Robot Man without touching the tattoo, and him and his brother merging. Do you guys think he's basically doing suicide by supervillain there?
No, I don't know. Because I think it's all about his love for Paula. I mean, it's all about his love for Tigress.
Yeah, but I wonder if he's like, he's trying to help her, but I wonder if he's like, okay, I'll save her and be rid of you finally. I just maybe not. It just flashed in my brain. It's just a thought. So.
I think there's so many history of superhero comics, people attacking foes much more powerful than them, and just, gumption's going to get you through. Now, for a superhero comic, it didn't seem that, the odds didn't seem that stacked against him,
Yeah.
Well, Chris, with that last line of his, go to hell and take this big metal bastard with you. I mean, maybe. Yeah. Wow. Maybe. I don't know, man. I don't know. I hadn't thought of that. All right, Noah, so tell us your thoughts on some of these characters.
Well, I like that Johnny Quick is the heart of it, the POV character for the reader. I mean, I kind of feel like Thomas did that a bit in All-Star Squadron. He was sort of everyone's go-to guy. He was kind of the glue that held people together socially. So I think he works well here. And the fact that he's divorced and jaded, is a bit emblematic of, from what I could tell, how Americans felt in the 50s. We had just won this war. We had defeated the greatest evil ever. We're on a glide path to the future. Everything's going to be great. And then before we know it, we're at each other's throats with communism and then, of course, the Cold War and all that. So, or the fear of communism and the Cold War. So I think he's kind of emblematic of how people were feeling. Like, I thought life was going to be great. Remember World War II? Wasn't life great then? Everything made so much sense. And now it just sucks. And I kind of feel like that's how people were feeling at the time, from my reading of it. Paul Kirk is a bit of a counterpoint to that. Like, it's not just this ennui. It's also like things are genuinely dangerous. Things are scary. And I can't process this past, and I can't process my memories of World War II and kind of the hangover it's left me with and the wreckage of that. So I think those characters are kind of two sides of the same coin. I will agree with you, Shag, that the Paul Kirk scenes, when I first read it, I didn't love them that much. But now I go back and I like them quite a bit, mm-hmm. because I think those are some of the best action in all four issues. Mm. Certainly some of the best art. That scene, I guess it's issue two, when he's being chased, he first meets Bob Daly and they're in the car and they're being chased, and he does the little kind of jumps up in the covered bridge and smashes through the front windshield of the crooks. Is so, and like, he puts his hands around his head. I love that, like, kind of realistic thing that, like, if you're going to smash the window feet first, you do want to cover your head. It's probably a good idea. That's my medical tip. So I like that a lot. I will say, I'm reminded of a Who's Who episode. You guys said something in an episode of Who's Who that had always bothered me. How God bless Jerry Ordway, but in All-Star Squadron, the new costume he designed for Tarantula was terrible. And it didn't
terrible. We said it didn't look anything like it belonged in the 40s, though. I agree with that. It looks like it's from the 80s.
Okay. Yeah, I 100% agree with that.
The words Jerry Ordway and terrible come out of our mouth.
I take that back, but I agree it did not look like it was from the 40s. But Smith does a version of that costume here. You don't see it very many times, but you see it a couple times. Smith gives him a new costume here that is perfect, that has the color scheme of the Ordway costume, but it does look like, and it's really cool. Like, I want to read a story where that costume is in there. Cause I really like that. I thought that was cool. And yeah, I mean, the other characters, I found the Rex Tyler thing, I guess this is similar to the Paul Kirk part. I was kind of confused. Like, well, is he addicted to Miraculo? Is he not? He's addicted to being a hero. What's causing the psychedelic properties? I found that confusing, but who cares? Because it results in some really, really good art, some really fantastic art. That double page spread where he's basically having the psychedelic freak out, mm-hmm. while he's fighting crime and his body turns to mercury and there's this close up shot of his face and there's like flowers coming out of his eye sockets is just awesome. Really cool. But yeah, it's just Robinson does this trick here, how every character gets a little something, gets characterization, gets some element of three dimensions to them, but it doesn't feel like overstuffed. It doesn't feel too busy. It's just, he weaves such a complicated, complex tapestry without really letting the seams show. That's what I love about the story. He goes for bold characterization and he succeeds. That's what I love about it.
Well, let's get a little, we've talked a lot about the writing. So let's start talking about some of the, and you brought up some, so it's a good segue for us there about some of Paul Smith's artwork. So Rob, you've got a deep, deep love for Paul Smith. Why don't you start us off? Is there anything about Paul you want to say, or is there anything about the particular panels or issue, anything in art at all that you want to cover?
Well, he has this remarkably clean line. He's his own inker, which I always think sometimes really works out well. I think sometimes a lot of artists are their own best inkers. Jim Aparo, great example. Alex Toth, great example. They basically ever did their own best inking. Like I said, his style, it's so funny. Something kind of what Noah just said about like post-war malaise. And we know that post-war in Hollywood gave birth to film noir as a movement. This idea of this sort of creeping dread that was seeping into the culture after the war. It was sort of like, well, now what? Well, this is like superhero noir, really. It's not in black and white. It's in bright color, and everybody's in these ridiculous costumes. But it has that kind of creeping dread to it of like, well, we defeated Hitler, and now what? And again, you know, we mentioned at the top of the show that the colors, Richard Ori. I'm not familiar with him at all outside of this series, but he colors the living hell out of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he works really well with Paul Smith's work. Again, the use of monochromatic sequences during like dream sequences or night sequences or flashbacks. He really knows kind of where to kind of really bring it up, and then other times just to let it be simple, let Paul Smith's work take the fore. I just like the way also with Paul Smith draws super people. He draws them well built, but not crazy. You know, I mean, they're muscly guys, but they're somewhat realistic builds. They're kind of built like the way muscle guys were built in the 40s, like weightlifters, you know, like Charles Atlas. They're not like these, you know, they're not Arnold Schwarzenegger because that wasn't the body type back then. Again, I really just think it is some of his best work. I mean, just jumping into the very end, the last page where he draws the Silver Age. I think that's the only time he's ever drawn Aquaman, ever. So I was just happy about that, just to see finally get one shot of Aquaman drawn by Paul Smith. But yeah, I mean, he, you know, again, with each book is 48 pages. I can't imagine how long it took him to do this. Again, he must have had a lot of it done before they actually, you know, put it out or whatever. But yeah, I just think it really is this combo of, there's probably some artists that could have handled this, but it, to me, like, this is such a perfect marriage of story with this kind of art style. I just think it's just a perfect marriage of the two disciplines of comic books. So yeah, I just think it's just remarkable work by him.
Yeah, it's absolutely stunning. There's no denying that. He's the perfect man for the job. Chris, why don't we go with you next? Any art stuff that jumps out you want to talk about?
Oh, I just in general, I think this is just a beautiful book, and I agree that the colors by Richard Ori just complement the art so well. But one thing I want to point out that Paul Smith's really good at is he's great at drawing different faces, different mm-hmm. body types, different posture, and he's got a ton of blonde guys to draw.
Yeah, he does.
Johnny Thunder, Johnny Chambers, Jonathan Law, all the Johns, Carter Hall, Alan Scott, you know, they're all blonde. And even Al Pratt's blonde, which he's usually red-headed. But everybody's got a distinct face. Yeah, Lance Gallant, he's blonde. You never question who's that talking. And like you said, they're all out of costume.
They're just in shirts and ties. Yeah.
There's shirts and ties, or, you know, in Carter's case, he's dressed like, you know, he's an Egyptian pharaoh. But, you know, but yeah, I mean, that's miraculous in and of itself. And I love just, he makes Paul Kirk look like he's genuinely lost it through this whole thing. Him and Ted Knight both look, the looks in their eyes. I mean, the fact that he does, and even when Paul Kirk's Manhunter again at the end, he's still got those beady eyes. You know, it's just that I just love that the fact the way he just the he must have done some hellacious model sheets for this series and really really nailed these characters down, because he draws them consistently from every angle. And I love the fact that they don't all look the same. You know, Alan Scott's hair looks like it's thinning a little bit, and at the end it looks like it's really thinned out, you know, when they show him in one of those last panels. So I mean, it's just those little touches really help sell the characters. And you know, drawing all the period stuff, he's fantastic at it. And this was, you know, during the very, very, very early days of the internet when he couldn't just Google stuff. Mm-hmm. So everything seems very authentic. I mean, that's, you know, you can take that for granted. Of course, you know, the artists in All-Star Squadron usually did a good job of that too. But that's still a skill, you know, and I think his storytelling is just top notch. I mean, you know, the words are great, but I mean, you could follow this story. You could take the words out and still probably follow the story and even get all the emotions. This is a very drama heavy book, and you know, Smith could sell it on the art alone. So it's just a tour de force. And if he quit comics after this, his legacy in the comics would be assured, you know. So. Mm.
And just think, he's drawing this in 1993, which is the peak of the extreme era.
Yeah.
And yet he's drawing in this classic style. Wow.
Yes.
All right. Noah, your thoughts on the art?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you said. You just said, Chris, about he's so good at drawing Paul Kirk as someone who's lost it, and I agree, but he's even better at drawing Ted Knight as someone who's lost it. Yeah. Ted Knight visually might be my favorite character in this book, just because he genuinely looks like the crazy sanitarium shut-in kind of guy. And there's that page toward the end of the first issue, you know, where it's nighttime, it's time to work. Mm. And there's, he's got all these scribblings, math scribble, which I wonder if that's real math or just gibberish. I don't know. You should ask a mathematician. But it ends, it says time to work. And there's this close-up panel of his face. He's got the cigarette hanging out of his mouth, you know, because Johnny left him his cigarettes. And he's just the wild-eyed genie, you know, the Doc Brown but scary kind of look. It's really pretty awesome. Like, you know, if I had to pick one panel of this whole book, well, a lot of the panels in the final climax scene, but that would be really up there. Yeah, I was immune to the X-Men mania, so I had never heard of Smith before. I never read any of his X-Men work until actually in preparation for this. I went and looked at some of it, and maybe because he's inking himself here, I like this a lot better. It just has that naturalistic look that really serves us well. You know, you talk about how they look like real people, right? They don't look like chiseled gods. And that's partly just how the costumes fall on people's bodies. Like, it literally looks like, yeah, people in good shape wearing clothes and not, you know, Michelangelo's David spray painted a bright color, right? And it just, that gets even more this idea that I love. Like, what if superheroes were real? Well, they'd look like this, right? They'd look a little ridiculous, but they'd also look pretty damn impressive. I agree that the coloring is fantastic. There's this weird thing where even if it's not nighttime, a panel will go completely dark blue to kind of indicate doom or horror. A great moment of that is right after Robot, in the climax when Robot Man kills Miss America, and then Hourman just grabs Robot Man's arm and rips it off and screams, "Maniac!" I just love that. And everything goes dark, and you're presumably still in a well-lit government building, but just the blue saturation gives it this horror feel.
That's, well, it also makes that explosive spark really pop, too.
Yeah, well, that too. I mean, I'm looking at the very end here, and the shot of the Starman's broken cosmic rod piercing through Dynaman's chest has a similar effect with sparks coming off of it. It's a real, I mean, I don't know enough about how comics work, whether that was Smith's choice or Ori's choice or whatever, but, you know, maybe it was the two of them together. Yeah, there are a lot of sparks in this comic now that I look at it. But
it's the,
yeah,
it's the 50s.
Yeah. Superheroes. Well, someone told me electricity is evil, so it makes sense. I listen to these shows. Yeah, so I don't know. I couldn't be more impressed with this artwork. And I talked about that silhouette thing, which I thought was really neat. An odd choice, but these very poignant panels of you just see the silhouettes. This book looks to me like it wasn't just drawn. It was really thought about. It was really thought through. I mean, you guys talk about how long it would take him to draw however many pages, but I imagine it took him just as long to just plan this stuff out. And yeah, how did he get involved? I mean, did he and Robinson know each other? Did they work on this together? This thing's a masterpiece.
And I can't believe it's 30 years old. Just, it feels
29. Fresh. 29.
Okay, fair enough. So I'll jump through some of this stuff quickly. So like the covers, for example, I just want to talk about those for a second. They all have this really nice trade dress where it's a solid background color with a circular image of some sort. Really sets it off, and they play with it. Like in one of the ones, the rats are climbing across the cover. Another one, the circle's on fire. It looks really great. And of course, also we should mention this is the 90s, so there's gold foil on the cover for Golden Age, because 90s. So that's always fun. There's a fun Easter egg. Now, I can't take credit for this one. I read this on a website, but in issue one, there's this huge splash page with lots of superheroes and of the Golden Age. Pretty much every superhero you can think of the Golden Age. And way in the back is Captain America. He's like, yeah, super tiny.
You never noticed that until you put it in the notes. Yeah,
you can also see Namor there too, I think.
Yep. That's awesome.
On the left, right under Black Condor's leg, you see Namor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you guys talked about the use of color. I want to mention that. I love how it starts in black and white. It's just talking about the 40s. Then they talk about the heroes. There's like explosive splashes of color for the heroes. And then once it goes back to everyday life, it starts in black and white again. And it's just, it goes for a little while, and then just the color slowly seeps in, like color coming up in a movie or something like that. I just thought that was really effective use of color and black and white stuff. I really dug that. I had some notes on some particular pages. I won't dwell on them. You guys have already mentioned Ted Knight with the chalkboard is like one of my favorite pages. Alan Scott kicking Sportsmaster's ass was amazing. Yeah. And I'm not saying Green Lantern. I'm saying Alan Scott. That's what was great about that.
Or Green Latrine, he calls him.
Yeah, that's right.
And they brought that back in Starman. Shade meets Alan Scott in an issue with Starman. And all he says to him is, Sportsmaster used to call you Green Latrine.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
And then in issue three, there's a great page where Starman, he's developed his cosmic rod and he's floating in the air. It's a full splash page. And he gets zapped by all the cosmic energy. And there's this great negative effect. It's really powerful from the art and the coloring. The whole thing's just greatly put together. But the last thing I want to mention about Paul Smith's artwork here is he does amazing crowd shots. I mean, you guys talked about the differences, bodies and stuff, but he's got so many obscure Golden Age characters in there. As a guy who has spent the last 11 years of his life going through who's who, page by page, panel by panel, even I don't recognize some of these people. So I'm like, wow, there's some deep, deep cuts in here. So that was very impressive. And why does the red bee always have to die? I'm sorry, that's a little bit. That's an aside. But yeah, it's just messing up all my red bee fan fiction.
Because his superpower is to control bees that live in his belt buckle.
What you just said was awesome, okay? You're confused.
And his main bee was named Michael. Like,
yeah?
Just like, you couldn't be more creative than that? Okay.
Noah's off the show, folks. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, that's it. I'm a red bee hater.
That's right. Yeah. All right, so we're going to talk about the legacy and then closing thoughts here. So, Chris, you want to lead us through some of the legacy of the Golden Age story?
Well, like I said, you know, this, I always kind of wondered, do you guys think this was pitched as an Elseworlds, or did they just say, yeah, this has got to be an Elseworlds?
I think Hitler's brain, it had to be an Elseworlds.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, there's so much. I mean, it's so much a sequel to All-Star Squadron that I kind of wonder. But anyway, it was, again, branded Elseworlds, but the continuity from this does indeed, again, show up in Starman. And also JSA to a lesser extent when Robinson and David Goyer start JSA, and then Geoff Johns takes over that title, which eventually becomes Justice Society of America. But so, there's things about this, in particular, Ted Knight's his mental breakdown over helping contribute to the bomb, like I said. So, yeah, this does carry forward, even though, you know, this obviously other stories contradicted this, like Jonathan Law was a character in Nightwing's book. You know, he lived in Dick Grayson's apartment building and things like that, you know. So this didn't happen in the post-crisis DC universe in most titles, but in some titles it did. That crisis really fixed all those problems, guys.
All right.
It's just too confusing. For me.
Why did I give Chris this soapbox? Oh, my gosh.
I was 9 years old and I figured out the multiple Earths, but for some reason they thought it was too confusing for me.
That's right. Yep.
And now they're doing it in multi-billion-dollar movie franchise.
Yeah, exactly.
That's true.
How about that?
Yes.
So, on other legacy stuff, since Chris won't pick up the ball and finish it, I'll do it for him. this story gets nominated for Best Finite Series for an Eisner Award, which is pretty impressive. Then Geoff Johns, later on in an interview, credits James Robinson's work on this story, on Golden Age, for igniting his love for the characters in it. And ultimately, his decision to accept writing duties on the JSA book in the year 2000. So, wow. So this story is what inspired Geoff Johns to take over JSA. And say what you will about Geoff Johns' career here, you know, good, bad, whatever, that JSA book is amazing. It's so stinking good.
Yes, definitely.
Do you think,
because I think of Geoff Johns, you know, first thing I saw him for was Stars and Stripes. Mm-hmm. So I always imagine he was always an Earth 2 Golden Age character lover based on that. I mean,
well, according to him, he says this is what sparked his love in the JSA characters, you know, the Golden Age characters.
So is it possible we wouldn't have the Stargirl TV series or any of that, if not for Golden Age?
I think that's quite possible. I think that's a very realistic possibility.
What a different world we'd be living in.
Yeah. Yes. There was a Silver Age series planned. So we got Golden Age. There was going to be a follow-up by James Robinson called Silver Age. You kind of get the hints of it there, right, at the end, Captain Comet. But it was going to be James Robinson and Howard Chaykin doing it. Now, I've read that it was supposed to be 1997 for that release, but I don't buy that. I think it was supposed to be much sooner, because I remember hearing about the Silver Age right on the heels of Golden Age, before Starman became a thing.
Yeah.
So, but the reports are that the Silver Age would have begun with Jim Harper, formerly the Golden Age Guardian, investigating a series of murders, and then he would discover that there's a lot more happening than he thought, with ramifications going all the way to the top of the American Cold War government. So, I mean, if you think about the effort Robinson put into this one, combine that with Chaykin and the Red Scare of the 50s, that would have been a pretty damn impressive thing to read, I think.
I think DC was probably terrified at the idea of what positions Howard Chaykin would put some of their most valuable IP in when the art came out.
You made that joke before I did.
I'm sorry, Chris. It's like
guaranteed to have 100% more S&M pictures, drawings in there.
You know, I mean, a lot for Black Canary to do in those stockings. Yeah. Yeah.
All right, so let's share some closing thoughts. You can either talk big picture or just something else you didn't get a chance to mention. I'm going to use my opportunity to talk about something that I thought was cool in here I didn't get a chance to mention earlier, which was a retcon. Well, I don't know if it's a retcon since it's an Elseworlds, but in this story, James Robinson says that the whole Spear of Destiny keeping the heroes out of Europe was complete BS. He says it was a cover story, and the truth was the Nazis had a guy named Otto Frenz, who was codenamed Parsival, who had the ability to negate superpowers. And that was actually what created the problems when the costume heroes tried to go over to Europe to end the war. So then the president issues a decree saying no masked men should go over to Europe because they can't risk losing any of them because it would be too big of a blow to morale. I really like that retcon. I think that retcon is really interesting. It works well. And I wouldn't have mind seeing that explored later. So I know it goes against our beloved All-Star Squadron, but I kind of dig it. So, all right, so let's go around the horn. We'll go with you next, Rob. Any closing thoughts on Golden Age?
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things that the Earth 2 characters afforded DC was that they could put some of their most famous concepts through changes that the main, I'm doing air quotes, main versions couldn't go through. You know, Batman could get killed off, Wonder Woman could have a daughter, Superman could marry Lois. They couldn't do that in the main books because they had to keep the characters in stasis. But the Earth 2, they could age. And one of the other ideas is the Justice Society characters could intermix with the more seedier parts of our politics. And, that happens here, obviously. I mean, it's in a grand sillier style with Hitler's brain being switched and whatever. But there's, they get into this whole notion of that the government coming out of World War II, wanted to kind of take down the New Deal and kind of go back to a lot of the things that had happened before the war. And, Paul Levitz introduced that idea in the Adventure Comics run of Justice Society, where we find out why the JSA retired, because the government kind of forced them to. And that's not a story you could have ever told with the Justice League of America. It was acceptable because by the time we got the story, it was grandfathered in. It was like, oh, well, that happened 20 years earlier, and that we knew that the government was wrong and the heroes are right. So they were right to retire. But that's not a story you could tell today because it would get you in all sorts of trouble. So I love that. I think Robinson, even though it's an Elseworlds story, he's continuing that tradition of involving these characters in the politics of the day. And it's an eternal theme that ever vigilant because, fascism is always creeping just around the corner, in some places more than creeping. And it's he takes it to an extreme here. Obviously you've got the heroes killing each other on like the steps of the Capitol building or whatever, but I like that it's got that grit to it, even though it's got all the silliness and all the other stuff going on. But it's an improbable mix, but it works really well. And I thoroughly enjoyed revisiting this after so many years.
Before we go to the next person, I just want to add, you talk about the Elseworlds and the main characters. Another thing to notice is this was in the era of every Elseworlds was Batman. It just seemed like at this point, every Elseworlds was Batman. And then they took the time to do a 4-issue one of this. Oh, impressive. All right, Chris, closing thoughts.
I will say that before I forget, I meant to bring this up. Rob, you'll probably get this reference. I think Captain Comet looks a lot like John Agar. He's being played by John Agar. Revenge of the Creature. He's in all the Universal 50s movies. If you've ever seen him, you know John Agar.
But anyway, standard bland leading man kind of guy.
Yes, he was. Yes, you know, this, I always feel like the Golden Age didn't have an official sequel, but its spiritual sequel is The New Frontier, Darwin Cook.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I definitely feel like they have a lot of the same, you know, it's putting those Silver Age characters in the time period of the late 50s. It could almost be a sequel to this if Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman had been in this book. But since this is an Elseworld, why aren't they? Again, that's my question. Why, you know, I know it would have threw Superman would have threw the whole and Wonder Woman would have thrown the whole book off its axis. No pun there. But I understand why they weren't. But again, he could have, because you know this is not in continuity, so you can use the Golden Age version of those characters. But no, I have done that before. I've read the Golden Age and then turned around and got my humongous New Frontier, you know, omnibus or whatever that giant, is that what that's called? The big one that's in the slipcase. It's like
the absolute edition.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. The absolute edition. I've gotten that out and, you know, as they used to say on the Fantastic Cast, kill the vagrant with it and then read it. You know, I mean, because it works beautifully. I mean, it's like you go from the late 40s right in through the 50s, and it's got that same kind of deconstructionist feel and that gritty period realism, but it also has this great respect for the characters in the medium, which this one does. So what kind of movie double feature would you watch together? If you've never done that, read those two books together. You'll have a great time.
That's a great idea. It really is. All right, Noah, your thoughts?
Yeah, I want to echo kind of what Rob said. You know, when I first read this, I was studying American history, but I wasn't really interested in politics. And so I got the McCarthy references and the anti-Red Scare paranoia references, but I didn't really feel them because I wasn't that interested in it. And also it was the 90s and politics didn't feel as fraught in this country. And, you know, I think one thing we all can agree on is politics feel fraught these days. So rereading it now, I feel that a lot more, the political element, the idea of are our leaders really, do they really have their best interests in mind or do they have ulterior motives? And I think everyone feels some of that. So in that respect, it hit me harder, a lot harder now. And also just the irony is like, why is this always British guys doing this, commenting, using superheroes to comment on American history and American culture, whether it's Robinson or Alan Moore. What does that say about us, right? So that's one way that I find this story to be even deeper and richer is that it really makes a statement about our country and who we are as a people. And I, you know, just in general, I think that's when superheroes are at their best and is when superheroes are used, not just, yeah, it's fun to watch stuff blow up and people fight in colorful costumes, but also when they're kind of used as this metaphor to talk about, you know, bigger issues about power, about strength, about honor, about glory, all those other things. Yet another way I think the story shines. And yes, we didn't get Silver Age. I was very disappointed by that, but thank God we got Starman because it took so much of these ideas and you know, 81 issues and 60 of them were awesome. So I'll take that. Well, you know, nobody's perfect. But I'll take that as a sequel more than, more than a lot of other great stories, more than the sequels we got of Watchmen. How about that?
Absolutely. No, and Starman is so much better of a sequel than the Silver Age crossover we actually got.
Don't even start me on that.
It was terrible. So, all right. Well, thank you. This has been great. I'm so glad we revisited this. Reading it, I knew I loved it, but just reading it again after so many years, it was so powerful and it really resonated. I think for all of us, you can hear that, all of us in our thoughts. So, Noah, why don't you tell the folks at home where they can find you online and find more of you?
So I am all about something called the Big Quiz Thing. I run a company that produces and stages live trivia game shows for corporate and private events in person and virtually because it's 2022. mostly in person these days again. Thank the Lord. You can learn about us at bigquizthing.com. You can learn about hiring us for your own events, what we do. You can take a test game. You can watch videos, all sorts of good stuff. I am also personally, I am on Twitter at Noah Tarno, where I talk more about politics. So be forewarned.
All right. So folks, if you want to be part of the conversation, go out to our website, firewaterpodcast.com/JSA presents. Leave your comments there on the show post. That's where a lot of the conversation is going to be. Our Facebook is Fire and Water Podcast Network, and our Twitter is JSA presents. So thank you again to Rob for being here. Thank you to Chris for being here. And, I think that's going to do it, folks. So until next time, join the fight.
For justice! Yeah, more or less.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
Harvey, not the Superman! Hey, pure Superman!
Yeah, Mr. Superman! Super-duper Superman! Is this not the land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this not the land is good! We would leave it if we could!
When the Fuhrer says, be is the master race! We hail! Hail! In the Fuhrer's face, not to love the Fuhrer is a great disgrace, so we hail! Hail! In the Fuhrer's face, when the Fuhrer says, be is the master race! We hail! Hail! In the Fuhrer's face, not to love the Fuhrer is a great